Today is the first day of Advent. So what? Who cares? What's the point? Who needs it? And why do we need to bother? Why don't we just arrive at the big day? Because actually Advent's looking forward to the big day anyway. Why don't we just get on with this busy life that we've got and arrive at Christmas Day and celebrate that day? Well, this morning, I want to remind us of why Advent is so important. And then I want to look at just one of the lessons it teaches us about putting the true significance of Christmas into context. First, isn't it good? Isn't it great that pretty much everybody that you know, everybody that I know, celebrates the coming of Jesus and his birthday? Isn't it fantastic that just about everybody we know celebrates that? Now, if you think about it, that date, Christmas Day, is in everybody's diary. I mean, it's a watermark for everybody. It's probably, with the exception of New Year's Day, it's the biggest day of the year. So many people around the world celebrate that day. So many people will, in this country especially, will have the day on holiday, if not a whole group of days on holiday. Many people will have parties. Lots of people will go and visit family. They'll have friends over. There'll be people who are opening presents. And, you know, all of this celebrating the coming of Jesus and his birthday. And isn't it fantastic that it's so prominent that they're celebrating that? And, of course, you know the answer to that is no, because that's not what they're celebrating. Even though Christmas contains a bit of a clue, Christmas, Christ Mass, Jesus celebration, the reality is Christmas has been hijacked. It has become a secular event, it has become a commercial event, and an awful lot of people wouldn't have a clue what the significance of Christmas is, who Jesus is, and ask a lot of children, they don't even know the difference between Jesus and Father Christmas. It's all part of the thing that they celebrate on holiday. And you know that that situation, it's been hijacked, it has been stolen, it's been changed. My concern is that Advent runs the risk of exactly the same thing happening to it. It has also been hijacked. What do you do to celebrate Advent? Do you do anything? Does anybody have an Advent calendar? Anybody? Yeah, a few of you, four, five people. This is what we do to celebrate Advent. Because Sunday mornings are rather intense for me, we have not had the opportunity to open door three. We'll do that at the end of the service, maybe. But this is our Advent calendar. This one, granted, has got chocolates in it. Not quite as holy as it might be. Good. Glad yours does, John. But this Advent calendar has all the doors so that we can open one each day and count down. And because it's a spiritual calendar, it has on the back of each door part of the Christmas story. We're building our way towards Christmas through Advent. Well, sales of Advent calendars apparently have rocketed. John Lewis said it is now selling 48% more calendars this year than it did last year. That's good, right? Wrong. Because consumerism has also long since taken over what was once a godly reminder of significance at Christmas. The most popular of the John Lewis 62 various calendars they offer is a Lego version. Yes, a Lego version, so children can take out little blocks out of each of the doors right the way through the 24 days leading up to Christmas, and then at the end of the time, build a nice little image of something. Playmobil have another one that does similar. It's the Jewel Thief Police Operation calendar set. What? Donkeys? Sheep? I don't remember the Jewel Thief, do you? And the tragedy is that both of those are nearly £20 each, and they could buy a cheap £2 one just as easily. Commercialism. Hey, the world's going really mad. Pets. pets are not left out of this either. There is a Fred and Ginger. Didn't they do Strictly? Anyway, Fred and Ginger cat and dog calendar. Yeah, that's on sale for £4 with pet treats behind each window. Maybe this is pet evangelism. I've not heard of it. I don't know. This year, there's also the first breakfast advent calendar, and this is coming from Kellogg's, who feature a 24 variety pack size box with cereal within it, £4. Actually, I'm a little bit tempted by that one, but that's just my peculiarity. Do you know what? One time, opening one of those windows each day in your calendar during December used to be enough to inspire the Christmas spirit as you're approaching Christmas Day. But now, versions with a gift behind each door are the new must-haves. And so calendars have become ridiculously expensive. I'll give you some examples. You might have heard, actually, just recently, there were hundreds of people queuing outside London's Liberty store for people to get their hands on a luxury beauty advent calendar. Did you hear about that? It sold for £175. It contained 15 full-size products and 10 samples that in total retailed £500. Hence the bargain. Half the stock had sold out online before the store even opened at 8:30 in the morning, making it Liberty's fastest selling and most successful product. Advent, the fastest selling, most significant product. And Jesus is not even close to being thought about. Many are explicitly for adults, so they contain perfume or alcohol. Joe Malone. Gentlemen, apparently that's perfume. Who would know? Joe Malone have an advent calendar, £300. Then there's a £100 Edinburgh gin calendar, which offers a swig-sized bottle behind each of the doors. It gets better. Master of Malt then sells an old and rare whiskey calendar for £999.95. And there is the very old and rare version, costing £9,999.95. Just call it £10,000, because if you can afford that, you can afford the extra 5 pence. Isn't this astonishing? And isn't there something deeply ironic about it? Two things that we remember in Advent. Jesus gave up his position of majesty and glory in heaven to come down in abject poverty. And Jesus will come again, the second coming, in judgment, when he will hold people to account for their greed and selfishness. And the double irony, therefore, is that people are using an Advent calendar that speaks of those, supposedly of those things, to celebrate greed and wealth. So I put it to you that Advent, like Christmas, is getting lost in the commercialism and secularism of this world. Not this morning, it isn't. I'm putting it back on the map properly. So let's look again at the principle of Advent and just one of the themes that comes in it, the theme of hope. Because Advent means coming. It means the arrival. It is taking the time to think and reflect on the coming, the arrival of Jesus. And its real meaning, what it will be. Because if you just celebrate Christmas morning, then you run the risk that what you're actually celebrating is just the events of the day. Donkeys, sheep, manger, straw, and you can get lost in the events of the day instead of the astounding magnitude of what God did in those events on the day. And if you think about it, isn't this a godly thing to do? To prepare. To prepare yourselves, because that's exactly what God did. He gave prophecies throughout the Old Testament to his people, speaking, looking forward to this event that was coming in Jesus. Isn't it what he did in all these New Testament announcements to Zechariah and Elizabeth, to Mary, to Joseph, through John the Baptist? That's what he did. Why would we not do it? Advent prepares us to understand the significance. Otherwise, it just becomes a day when we think about, oh, yes, a wonderful birth in unusual circumstances, and our thoughts start going towards nappies and who's sleeping well at night and all the things of any other baby coming into this world. It speaks of one coming, and it speaks, therefore, of a longing, of an anticipation of this great event to come. Now, anticipation is something you all know about, because you all do it. You all anticipate. Every one of you in the church. Richard anticipates. He anticipates locating the place where he put his glasses or his keys. I'm sorry, it's true. Jackie anticipates the next time Richard's going to lose his glasses or his keys. Sandra anticipated for months that wonderful wedding celebration. And when she's read the church article, she'll be anticipating the opportunity to have a little chat with me. Alan and John were in hospital and were anticipating the opportunity to come home and be at home again. Maybe some of you are anticipating medical procedures to come. Margaret looks with anticipation for that day when someone will step up and volunteer to do the church accounts. See? But you do it so well, and we all know you do it well, and you look useful on it, so keep going, please. John, every Sunday, looks forward with anticipation to that roast chicken dinner. True? Yes. And Sam and Lorinda are looking with anticipation to the end of term. And for slightly different reasons, Chris too, probably, to the end of term. And Larry and Joy are looking forward with anticipation to their next holiday. And Sue to the next opportunity she can put her gorgeous grandchild in her arms once more. And I could go round and do that for everyone. We all know anticipation. And I am looking forward with anticipation to that Christmas morning opening of the box that has a lovely ribbon around it and taking out those two brand new jangly keys to my new Aston Martin DB9. No? No. Okay, well, all of those things are things that we look forward to, and we do. They're nice, and it's a bit of fun. But I want to be really serious for a minute. What if the anticipation that you have and are patiently waiting for is for something much, much more? Is for literally a life-changing answer to utter desperation. I'm going to share with you, I believe I am out talking to more and more people in the church and outside of the church for whom that is the reality. They are surrounded by utter desperation, and they are looking forward to the day when something happens to change it. That's what they're longing for. An answer to the pain, the hurt, the sadness, the bereavement, the loneliness. Looking for an answer. Which is the reason that Advent is so important. Because in Advent, we can use this period of time for the penny to drop, to start to wait, to prepare, to understand that that's precisely why Jesus came. He came in this, yes, amazing, unbelievable event, but to be God's answer to the most desperate hopelessness that you could ever imagine, and that our world is absolutely full of today still. And as we look back in our Old Testaments, we begin to see that generation after generation of God's faithful people were able to do just that. They were able to place their hope in something that was to come. They placed their confidence and trust in God, who would deliver. And time again, he answered their prayers with short-term issues that were relevant. But there's a thread that goes through it where they see hope for something much bigger still to come. Because hope is not just a Christmas promise. It is a theme that is woven right through the biblical narrative or story like a golden thread. And it draws our attention and our anticipation to God's eternal answer to human brokenness in the coming of an anointed one, Jesus. And that's the reason why at times in Advent we go back to look at the example of the patriarchs, our forebears, to people who are famous in the Bible because they saw God answering their circumstances, but saw an even bigger answer beyond. I want to go back to something I mentioned a couple of weeks, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago maybe now, when I said that God often introduces himself to people in the Old Testament as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Do you remember that? I know, because Lorinda said to me after I'd finished, do you realize that all the way through you kept on saying the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Joseph? But you said it was supposed to be Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it was because I was giving the example of Joseph and I was switching them around. I was supposed to say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's me. Actually, both phrases are used. Why? Why does God introduce himself in that way? Because these patriarchs, these original fathers of faith, are mentioned again and again because they were the ones through whom God demonstrated his faithfulness and proved his trustworthiness. And they could hold on to that faith, but they had hope because they were also the ones through whom he gave signs of something bigger coming down the road. They set the scene. So every time later in our Old Testament, we find God introducing himself to people, the ancestors, oh, you're the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now we understand. You're the God who delivers on what he said. But there's even more to come. That's why Advent is a time when we think about the patriarchs. And I want to just touch on some of them briefly. So Abraham, for example, called to move from his home to another land and promised three things. Told that God would make him into a great nation, that he'd be the father to many, which was an astonishing thing to say to someone who was with his wife infertile and at the age of 75 or so. That was the promise that God made. He still had to wait for it. He was almost 100 by the time that promise came into practice. Because on that journey, God's faithfulness was demonstrated and he saw the reality of who his God was. There were things to learn. Then God promised him land. And it was centuries before his descendants would gain the benefit of that promised land. He also promised him that all people would be blessed through him. Well, the nation of Israel did, for a time, bless some of the nations around. But that promise was not fully seen for another 2,000 years when Jesus was born. And suddenly that blessing came to all men and women, including you and me. Promises given. A God who demonstrated he was faithful, but they had to wait. In every case, waiting. Then there was Isaac, his son, a man of extraordinary faith. With so many hassles, he had to deal with rebellious sons, Jacob, Esau, a wife who was manipulative, Rebekah. But he trusted God. He put his faith in God and he had hope and he knew something better still was coming. And it was demonstrated at the end as he passed his blessing on to his two sons, Esau and Jacob. Let's go to Jacob. Jacob was the one who cheated his brother, wrestled with God, and spent years in exile. How astounding his life was. But again, someone to whom God made those same eternal promises. He lived in exile. He suffered deception, even at the hands of his father-in-law, who caused him to work for so many years for it to gain his wife, and then gave him the wrong daughter. So he had to work another 7 years for the wife he wanted. And yet he retained his confidence that God had something better. In every case, hardships, the devastation of sins, broken lives, but they maintained a hope that God always had something better. And none of these people saw the promised land that had been promised. And then, of course, there's Joseph. And Joseph was the next generation, sold into slavery. The absolute horror that he experienced in Egypt. But at the end, when he came all the way through and his brothers came to him, having sold him into slavery, thinking, what's his reaction going to be? And he turns to his brothers and says, no, you intended this for harm, but God intended this for good. That's trust in a faithful God and a hope in something much better that's coming. And Joseph didn't see the promised land. But then, centuries after these events, after Israel had had the high point of David and Solomon, the divided nation came, the rebellion, turning their backs on God and a succession of kings that rejected God. And God sent a whole series of prophets, but two that I want to mention, chosen by him to speak out his warnings, Isaiah and Jeremiah. Let me start with Jeremiah. Given the unenviable task of telling the people exactly what the consequences were going to be, he was told to tell them exactly what was going to happen to Jerusalem and to Babylon. It made him incredibly unpopular. He was often in physical danger from his own people. He was ignored. He was mocked. He was assaulted, and he was forced into hiding. And God asked him to persevere and to endure and to hold on to his hope that there was something better. Do you know that Jeremiah is known as the weeping prophet? Because his writings are basically so miserable. It's depressing. He wrote, he spoke, he said what God asked him to say, and it felt like he was getting nowhere. In the book of Lamentations, we get a hint of this. The clue's in the name. He was lamenting his circumstances. Let me read from Lamentations 3, 19 to 26. He says this, I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore, I will wait for him. In Jeremiah's darkest times, he looked beyond his own personal circumstances. And because of his hope, he was strengthened and through his assurance of the love of God, who somehow he knew had a solution that was well beyond his understanding. God had just asked him to wait quietly. I know sometimes exactly how we must have felt. And then in Isaiah, who lived also in turbulent black days for the nation. Do you know that Isaiah wrote his book with 66 chapters? Same number of chapters as the Bible has books. In the first 39 chapters, the same number of books as are in the Old Testament, he paints a damning picture of the consequences of a chosen people who've rejected and turned their backs on a faithful God. But in chapter 40, 40th book of the Bible, is Matthew, the New Testament. In chapter 40, there's suddenly a change. There's hope. It begins, comfort. Comfort my people. And it goes on with these most famous words, a voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way for the Lord. And we'll see in 2 weeks' time that John the Baptist is the one who fulfilled that calling. Pointing who to? Jesus. But we read this morning from Isaiah 61. And these incredible words that should set the scene for you for what Christmas is really about. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, to release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And now you come to the real significance of what Christmas actually is. That the God of love, of compassion, even in the face of total rejection and denial and rebellion from his people, had already planned hundreds of years, centuries before Jesus came. He'd already planned a way back, reconciliation, restoration, wiping the slate clean for everybody who believed in his son, Jesus. That's what Christmas is really about. To the poor of spirit, those who are so desperate, they are happy to say, I don't care if tomorrow doesn't come, let me die now. To the brokenhearted, who this world, they feel, has dumped something on them they cannot cope with. The captives, the tormented, those who are treated unjustly everywhere in the world. Those who are prisoners. This is not just speaking about people who are in a prison behind a jail sentence because of what they've done. That includes them too. But all who are prisoners of the consequences of sin, of our broken world. To all of them, God did something and he sent Jesus to be the answer. For all who put their trust and their hope in him. That's the consequence of Christmas. And the patriarchs therefore speak out God's faithfulness, but they look forward to that time when something even better will come. And Jesus was that time. That's the anticipation, the hope of Advent. That's the reason I believe this world is crying out for the real solution that Jesus offers. That when life is really, apologies, but is really as crap as it is for so many people, that there is someone who knows and who is there and who will stand and listen and loves them and will give them a solution that won't just overcome their immediate issues, but will allow them to face it, conquer it, and go beyond it. As Jeremiah and Isaiah understood, and as people today who are afflicted with the most appalling things but have Jesus as their hope have come to understand, and then offers more, a hope that is eternal, that will heal hearts. That's the significance of Jesus. That's the significance of Christmas. And that's why Advent is important, because we recognize in it, we prepare ourselves for the true significance. So what can we do about it? Well, I want to encourage you to put Advent on your radar. I want to encourage you to do something. Practical time. I've got six things for you to do. Number one, mark Advent. If you've not got one, try and get hold of one. Help some of the people like Leprosy Mission, all the other people you support, BMS, and see what Advent calendars that they've got. Make Advent real by allowing God to prepare you. Be part of these Advent talks. Read your Bibles every day. If you don't know what to read, I've prepared something for you. No excuses. Actually, there are 28 things. I must have got a bit carried away. Just cross them off each day. This is just two verses, but they will prepare your soul. They will invite God to just say a little bit every day, that when you arrive on Christmas morning, you know what that day's really about. The world's treating it like a joke and like something to praise ourselves and to celebrate because of all the stuff that goes with it. You need to be different. We can be different. So I've got a huge number of these. When you come to sign the cards, please, please take one. I'll get more. All that is number one, by the way. Two. During Advent, I don't know whether you can do this, but this is what I share from my heart. This is what God's been saying to me. Every time during Advent that you see brokenness on your news screen, in your newspaper, from the people you talk to when you hear in the church, in your families, in your neighborhoods, every time you see or hear brokenness, also see Jesus. Put the two together so that the first thing you see when an ambulance is, that person needs Jesus. When the first thing you see when someone's getting divorced, that person needs Jesus. When you see a child who's torn apart because they don't know who the family parents really are, see Jesus. Because what it will do is it will teach you who Jesus really came for. It'll teach us what Christmas is really about. I really encourage you, please, try and do that. Three. If you're one of the people that's hurting, or you know someone who's hurting, help them to look to the example of the forebears who held on to a hope despite the stuff they were going through. If it's someone else, pray for them. If it's you, remind yourself of what those people suffered, but Jesus was the hope. Four, send Christmas cards. Please do, but don't have a flipping robin on the front. As for your garden, I encourage you, think about the cards you send. Put a Christian message in. When the world is sending stuff to do with Christmas that's all about money and all about me, 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 and having a good time and eating more and celebrating more and all the rest of it, if God's people can't put Jesus on the agenda, who's going to? Think about the cards that you send. Five, make sure there is something in your house that speaks of the true message of Jesus. I'm not saying don't put up a little nice fluffy hat of Father Christmas if it does it for you. We've got unbelievable decorations that have been donated to us over the years. Some of them we joke about and we can't bear to put up. But, you know, sometimes you put jangly stuff up and it's nice. Put decorations up and enjoy it. God wants us to enjoy it, of course. But when people come to your house, do they see something of Jesus? Is there something, nativity something? Or is it all Father Christmas covered dolphins? And finally, I suspect that all of you will have family and friends coming to your house, or you will go to them. Here's the bit where you really stand up and have some courage. I want to encourage you to pray in advance of any of those times to put Jesus on the agenda. Have the courage to say, to have an opportunity to a grandchild or to whatever. You play with the games, have fun, think about the presents, it's lovely. But at some point, pray for the right opportunity. Don't preach, but the right opportunity to say, well, the best thing for me about Christmas is the present that God gave Jesus. Who knows what that will open up? When you invite people around and you have a meal, don't just say, thank you, Lord, for the food that we have. I hope you do that anyway. But say, and at this Christmas time, we thank you for Jesus. Put Jesus back on the map. You do the Advent speaking where the world is not doing it. Six things. If you want the details again, I'll give them to you. Or speak to brilliant people like Annalise who write things down. My encouragement, let's bring Jesus and the real meaning of Christmas into the heart of these days as we come to that time. Let's pray.